Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Old story, Iran laughs at the industrialized world?
No, because their disarray, I think, needs a restructure of their society.
The brown-eyed peoples are teaching the blue-eyed peoples something.
Well, no, we are not teaching something. The blue-eyed people have to wake up.
When the Shah of Iran made those statements on 60 Minutes to a very brown-eyed Mike Wallace back in 1975, Iran was a U.S. ally who openly intimidated the West with the oil weapon. Subsequent Iranian leaders have found other ways to intimidate Western leaders. In the global Iran drama, Obama's up.
As far as we are concerned, we are not the toys of any country.
Iran toying with the West? Who's having fun? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 9th, and The Takeaway is certainly Iran is not dominating the headlines, but we're trying to find the themes in U.S.-Iranian relations at this point in the administration.
If they're not dominating the headlines, it's not for lack of trying. Let's get right to the top stories this morning. The wave of recalls continues to engulf Toyota. This morning, the company officially recalled 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids sold here in the U.S. last year. That's part of the latest recall of more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. Here's Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
If you're keeping a tally, that makes nearly 9 million cars and trucks recalled by Toyota worldwide in recent weeks.
John Murtha, the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in Congress, died yesterday following complications from gallbladder surgery. Murtha was 77. He wielded considerable clout for two decades as the ranking Democrat on the committee which oversees Pentagon spending. The Pennsylvania congressman was also opposed to the war in Iraq.
Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America.
By making that public statement in 2006, he did change the course of U.S. policy. Murtha spent 36 years in Congress.
This morning, Iran says it has begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%. That's far short of the 90% needed for nuclear weapons, yet it still increases fears that Iran is edging closer to producing a bomb. In response, the U.S. says it wants the United Nations Security Council to approve a resolution in weeks, not months, that would impose new sanctions against Iran.
We're going to discuss the nuclear issues between the U.S. and Iran in a moment, but for more, Hamid Debashi joins us. He's professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. Professor, would you say in this stage there's more equilibrium or instability in the U.S.-Iranian relation at this stage in the Obama administration?
Certainly instability, but the fact that overshadows that is that both President Obama and Mr. Ahmadinejad need each other. President Obama to get out of the mess that he inherited from President Bush, and Mr. Ahmadinejad to distract attention from his domestic problems.
All right. Is that mutual need an opportunity? We'll be back with you to talk more about that in just a moment. Hamid Debashi, stay with us.
The White House wants to know why Anthem Blue Cross, California's largest for-profit health insurer, is raising premiums by almost 40%. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has asked the company to provide justification, especially in light of the fact that they made nearly $3 billion last quarter alone.
Within the hour, First Lady Michelle Obama is launching a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, Dr. Joe Thompson, Surgeon General in Arkansas, a state with one of the worst obesity problems in the nation, said the rise in childhood obesity is not about genetics.
It really is basically because our kids are eating far more calories than they need, and they're not burning off as many by being physically active.
What is your strategy for getting your kids to slim down? 877-8MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Markets quickly. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway under 10,000. The Nasdaq opens at 21.26. Good morning, everyone. You know, it's kind of amazing to recall that exchange back in 1975. Messages.
I've never heard that. It really is.
Message from the brown-eyed people to the blue-eyed people. Mike Wallace interviewing the Shah of Iran in 1975.
Yeah, it's an amazing tape.
That was, you know, 2 years after the so-called energy crisis. It was long before the Ayatollah, long before, you know, President Ahmadinejad. But the themes of U.S.-Iranian relations are long and venerable and have bedeviled White Houses for really more than a generation. I mean, you can say that taking the focus off the situation in Iran, which it feels like is right now, might constitute something of a feeling of relief for Americans who have observed crisis after crisis in U.S.-Iranian relations. But not paying attention to Iran has been a problem for American presidents from Carter through Reagan straight up to the present day. This morning, more signs of issues to come. Iran says it has begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%. That's far short of the 90% needed for nuclear weapons, but it still increases fears that Iran may be close to having the infrastructure to eventually produce a bomb. China has called for more talks in the wake of these developments, but doesn't want to talk about actual sanctions. Rejoined now with Hamid Debashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, and Houman Majd, a journalist and author of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran. Good morning once again to both of you.
Good morning, John.
So, Houman Majd, let's talk with you first. Where would you say U.S.-Iranian relations are right now? Hamid Debashi said at the top of the hour that Ahmadinejad and President Obama need each other for reasons that are relatively unprecedented in U.S.-Iranian relations. But do you feel as though this relationship is stable or unstable right now?
Well, I would certainly agree with Professor Debashi that it is incredibly unstable. Actually, it's quite ironic that a year into President Obama's presidency, after 8 years of George Bush, that we're at this stage right now. Everyone expected, obviously, relations to be at a more stable place than they are today. But, of course, the election of 2009 in Iran has caused a little bit of a hiccup in all of that, of course. But regardless, in terms of purely the nuclear issue, certainly it's very, very unstable. And I'm not sure it's entirely the Iranians' fault at this point.
Well, why don't you elaborate on that? Whose fault would it be?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think there are many, many factors involved in the nuclear issue, but I think that President Obama, who had promised negotiations with Iran and went through with the promise, certainly in October, has since October not really engaged Iran at all, other than essentially telling Iran to either accept the deal that was made in October, the offer that was made in October, or else. Iran has, in fact, a few times offered to negotiate further the deal that they rejected in October.
Right, and that's the offer to have a bilateral actual dialogue with Iran, which might be a prelude to something much more like we had under the Shah, which was actual diplomatic relations, embassies, that sort of thing. Hamid Debashi?
That's a long way.
Of course it is. Of course, absolutely. We don't want to go down that road. But Hamid Debashi, react to what Houman Majd was saying there.
No, I agree with Houman Majd that the relationship is in a standstill, but what he also knows is that since June we have had a massive civil rights movement in Iran, and millions of Iranians don't believe Ahmadinejad's government to be a legitimate government. And as a result, President Obama does not have a partner to talk to that the majority of Iranians accept. And as a result, what Ahmadinejad is doing is trying to bring the global attention away from domestic woes of his inside Iran towards either the geopolitics of the region or the nuclear issue. And as a result, every day we have contradictory news from his government. One day he accepts to shift the enrichment outside Iran. The other day, no, he's enriching inside Iran, which is his best bet. Not only just his government, but the entire fate of the Islamic Republic is now contingent on taking the world attention away, especially over the next few days. We have the anniversary of the revolution 31 years ago, and there are plans for massive, massive demonstrations against his illegitimate government, and as a result, this is yet another trick from his bag of tricks.
And we should stipulate that while the government in Iran is not popular, the nuclear issue actually is something that can move the needle in polling and in sort of a popular support of a government policy. Hamid Debashi, when you see the White House and industrialized nations sort of playing something of a waiting game, thinking that the instability of the Iranian government may eventually overtake Ahmadinejad, do you think back in history to times when, you know, at certain points of instability, you know, covert operations took down the government? Do you think that the U.S. has levers that it can pull, hoping that the instability of Iran reaches some threshold where we might trigger events inside the country?
Well, there are certainly forces within the U.S. Congress that have stipulated severe economic sanctions, covert operations, and even military strikes. But I don't believe that any one of them will have any benefit to for this particular result. Yes, the Ahmadinejad government is very, very stable, but also the fact is that the Islamic Republic is entrenched within three layers of militarized security apparatus and is not hasn't anywhere to go. Ayatollah Khamenei is not the Shah. He doesn't have any Swiss chalet, or if he does, right, he's not in the way of traveling there.
Hamid Debashi is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University. We're also talking with Houman Majd, who's a journalist and author of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Paradox of Modern Iran. We heard that exchange between Mike Wallace and the Shah of Iran, where the Shah of Iran said the message from the brown-eyed people to the blue-eyed people is wake up. If Ahmadinejad was asked that same question today, Houman Majd, what do you think his answer would be?
Oh, I think you probably have the same answer as the Shah had. I think there's a certain arrogance there. There's no question. And by the way, I agree that the timing of this announcement of the 20% enriched uranium is definitely linked to the domestic issues in Iran. And Ahmadinejad certainly wants to divert attention away from his own domestic troubles. But I do think also that Iran is adamant that it will do as it pleases and will not be dictated to the West, by the West. And I think that is a relatively popular opinion inside Iran, amongst the people, regardless of the, you know, which side you're on, whether you're on the Green Movement side or on the government side.
Very quickly to both of you, it's a yes or no. Hamid Debashi, is the Obama administration losing an opportunity in these months?
No.
All right. Houman Majd, what would you think? Is the Obama administration losing or taking advantage of an opportunity in Iran?
I think they are potentially losing an opportunity,
right,
potentially.
Hamid Debashi, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia, and Houman Majd, journalist and author of The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, talking about U.S.-Iranian relations. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following this morning.
Another blow for Toyota today. It says a brake problem means it will recall 130,000 vehicles in the U.S. That's part of a worldwide recall of more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid vehicles. Toyota President Akio Toyoda says the company is committed to fixing the problems.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
Akio Toyoda says he'll personally take the lead on the company's commitment to quality. The First Lady launches a campaign to fight childhood obesity today. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Joe Thompson, the Surgeon General in Arkansas, a state with one of the highest obesity rates, and he told us what his state is doing to combat the problem.
Trying to improve the cafeteria offerings in the school, trying to increase the level of activities both within the school and changing the environment around the school so that kids can walk and bike again. And we're raising awareness.
And in light of the First Lady's new battle, we're asking you, if you've ever gone on a diet, has anyone told you? You'll probably know. It's harder than it sounds. And we're wondering if you have any tips for either helping your kids lose weight or losing weight yourself, and what are your personal vices that keep you from doing it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
A couple final stories. Pennsylvania Congressman John Murtha has died at 77 of complications from gallbladder surgery. He fought in the Vietnam War and later became a leading advocate for veterans on Capitol Hill. And in Haiti, the UN says it will cut off shipments of free medicine to hospitals that charge patients after learning some treatment centers were hitting patients with fees for materials they got for free. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Coming up, the Dow dipped below the 10,000 mark yesterday. What does it mean? Anything? We'll talk to Louise Soria about it.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on news stories we're following this morning. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped below 10,000 yesterday. It hit that magic number last November. It stayed there, floated above there for a few months, and yesterday fell below. We're joined now by Louise Story, business and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. So what is it about 10,000 that makes it the magic number, Louise?
Well, 10,000 stood out during the tech bubble, you know, the big stock market run-up in the 90s, as the goal. And right. It had never passed 10,000. And when it did pass 10,000, in 1999, there was champagne on the stock exchange floor, and it was a really big deal. And that has forever minted that number in investors' minds as the thing to be above. And actually, since then, we've passed it 57 times. So we've really wavered around. Before the financial crisis, we hit the peak of 14,000 in October of 2007. And if you talk with anyone who's a stock investor, which you know a lot of people have their retirement savings there, they will tell you that despite the run-up from the last year getting back above 10,000, it still feels pretty bad to be this low below 14,000 where we were in October 2007. So some of the things that are worrying people are the crisis in Europe, the concerns about sovereign debt, Greece, Spain, Portugal, and also the sustainability of this recovery that looks like we're having but is very tentative, and also the fact that the Fed is going to have to start pulling liquidity out of the system. And so people are really worried that we don't really belong above 10,000 now with the state of the American economy.
Yeah, lots of people were saying that the 14,000 mark was unsustainable anyway, and how good of an economic indicator is the stock market anyway?
Well, you know, it certainly indicates people's expectations of economic growth and corporate earnings.
Okay. Louise Story is a business and finance reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Louise.
There's also computers that trade on the 10,000 number, right? I mean, it's like... Yeah, it's interesting. So it's robots as well. So our next takeout is really in the form of a question. What's the value of your own sense of home? This feeling of being in a place that's safe and yours, and a place that's not going away. It's hard to find a number for something like that. 10,000 doesn't really cut it. But Takeaway correspondent Farai Chidea found someone who has had to make that calculation. In our series, The Value, we hear stories of how harsh economic times have refocused the idea of what has actual value. Today, Farai brings us the story of a woman in Miami who found the values of home in a pretty unlikely place. Good morning, Farai. Tell us about Sierra Jones.
Now, I had this chance to visit an incredible 22-year-old woman named Sierra Jones, and she's already gone from being pregnant and homeless to having her own apartment and running a store. She is very clear about what kind of life she wants to lead, but she has had a hard time getting there.
I came up in a not-so-good environment where there was a lot of drugs and alcohol and abuse, and that's something that I would learn from and try my best. You know, I can't predict the future, but it's nothing that I'm interested in, and it's nothing that I want my daughter to have to grow up around.
You know, she is a mom now, this 22-year-old, and really in part, but only in part, this story is about how raising kids refocuses your idea of the value of home.
Absolutely. And she has had a very rough road in terms of family. She's someone who told me exactly how abruptly it was that her life changed.
I was actually in my first year of college in Tallahassee, Florida, on a scholarship, model student, and I ended up pregnant. So I decided to come back home and stay with my mom and try to do school here. It was never really a good situation at my mom's home ever since I was younger. So eventually it led to them giving me a day to find somewhere to live.
So she's given a day to find somewhere to live. And here, you know, you might think that because she was a model student and was on a scholarship that everything unraveling shows that she doesn't really understand the value of these opportunities. But in fact, it was just the reverse. Once she started to look on her own for a living situation, she found the values that we all take for granted.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's worth pointing out is that she was just embarrassed. She was embarrassed to be pregnant and a student. She wasn't failing. But, you know, instead of falling completely out of the world, she got this place, Lotus House. She found
it's a shelter.
It's a shelter.
Right.
A really great shelter in Miami. She found a place there, had her baby while she was there. Now she manages the thrift store for the shelter, and, you know, she's raising her daughter, Chastity. She told me about the shelter, Lotus House.
I just thought to myself, this is a shelter. This is better than my mom's house. I just thought, well, how nice for it to be a shelter. And I opened the fridge, and there's food in the fridge. There's cheese and yogurt and everything you need when you're pregnant to nourish the baby, and new sheets. And I'm just thinking, I never had this stuff at my mom's house.
This gives you an indication of, you know, how far she's come.
Absolutely. And now she has her own apartment. She's pregnant with her second child. She wants to open an office and computer center in the Overland area of Miami. It doesn't have a lot of jobs or services. She wants to hire women from Lotus House to help run it, and she's really happy being a mom.
Now, do you think she can make it work? I mean, we hear a lot of dreamy stories of people that have all the sort of spirit that you can imagine, but it's a daunting economy right now.
Well, you know, everyone at the Lotus House has to work, and her job was to be the personal assistant to the woman who runs the organization. Mm. So she has had her own unofficial MBA. This is a woman who knows business.
She's got a mentor.
I believe in her.
Yeah. And she could find her way back to college.
Yeah, she could find her way back to college, or like people like Bill Gates, she could just go without a degree and make her way.
Farhad Jadeja, ambitions very, very high there, but a great, great story. As always, our series, The Value, is online, and you can see video of Ciara Jones and the Lotus House at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Farai.
Thanks, Don.
Coming up, we're going to find out what happened to the 33 Haitian children that were involved in that alleged child trafficking case that involved a Baptist group. More on that in a few minutes. But we're also following the First Lady's fight against childhood obesity. Her campaign begins today. But if you've ever been on a diet, you know that it's difficult. It's really hard to eat well, exercise, and lose weight. So we want to get your personal tips. Not just for your kids, but for adults, too. What are the tips that you have? And if there's one particular thing that keeps you from losing weight, for me, it would be barbecue potato chips. That's my vice. What is yours? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website.
Not eating.
TheTakeaway.org. Not eating?
Not eating. It works for me.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, you've heard the stories about the U.S. Baptist group that's accused of kidnapping 33 Haitian children. But what happened to those 33 kids? We're going to find out in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Toyota's tumble continues. This morning, the company officially recalled 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids sold here in the United States last year. That's part of the latest recall of more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. John Murtha, the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in Congress, died yesterday following complications from gallbladder surgery. Murtha, who was 77 years old, represented a district in southwestern Pennsylvania known for its steel mills and coal mines. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell says it's a big loss for the state.
He supported the military and he made sure that the military had the right resources, but he didn't. He had the courage and the intellectual integrity to, as much as he loved the military, to make sure that the military was on the right track.
Murtha spent 36 years in Congress. And in Haiti, our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that private medical evacuations of children to the U.S. have largely stopped. That's because aid workers and doctors are worried about being accused of kidnapping if they don't get the necessary paperwork, which is often slow to arrive or unavailable.
More on Haiti in just a moment. The White House will spend nearly $80 million to help keep the giant Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. It's an environmental concern. The money will go for sonar, electric shocks, and netting. The carp, a hungry, huge, non-native fish, threatens the ecosystem in the entire Great Lakes region. In Colombia, authorities are describing it as their biggest anti-drug operation in a decade. Police say they've arrested more than 20 people, mostly experienced airplane pilots who fly drugs to Mexico. They've been extradited to the U.S. We've been doing a lot of coverage of childhood obesity this morning. Here's another look, and this story might make Homer sing.
When I was 17, I drank some very good beer.
Beer drinkers may have a good excuse to order another round, we learned. Researchers at the University of California say beer is a rich source of silicon, a key ingredient in increasing bone density and preventing osteoporosis. And that concludes the Simpsons portion of the broadcast. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 9,908, the first time it's opened under 10,000 since November. But with those futures, it'll probably pop above 10,000 shortly. The S&P opens at 1,056, and the NASDAQ starts at 21,26. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Good morning. For the past few weeks, we've been watching the developing story about the Baptist group from the U.S. who are accused of kidnapping 33 Haitian children. You may have wondered what happened to the kids themselves. Well, we have the answer for you. We've got Heather Paul. She's the CEO of SOS Children's Villages in the U.S. That organization was asked to take on the task of caring for these Haitian children and trying to find their relatives. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning, Celeste.
First, can you give me a status on these kids? Do you still have all 33 of them?
I believe we do, and it's very important that we conduct a full investigation as to why those children are there and the condition of their parents, what they knew when they gave those children into the hands of the missionary. So this is a proof positive why tracking, registration, and protecting those children is uppermost before we really determine their long-term future.
Have you found any of these kids, their parents or relatives?
Yes, parents and relatives have identified themselves, and that's all part of the investigation, again, as to whether these children are safe in the arms of their parents or extended family, and that's exactly what our investigations are about. We've been doing this in 130 countries for the last half century, so we know that these issues of children without parental care are very complex. And the motivations and the reasons why children are candidates for SOS Children's Villages or indeed final adoption need to be done very carefully.
Well, this kind of plays into what we've been hearing a lot lately, which is that there's no such thing as an orphan in Haiti. That's something that we've heard. Can you kind of explain what that means?
Well, I don't really think that's true. There are real orphans right now. We know that children have been their parents have died in this terrible disaster, and perhaps extended family as well. Oftentimes in countries, there are what we call social orphans, where mothers and fathers and extended family are simply unfit and unwilling to take care of their children. And each situation really is quite different, so we can't have sweeping generalizations as to how many children should be adopted, how many are real orphans. We just right now are in the course of registration and protecting children in safe havens as much as we possibly can. We know that in the chaos of natural disaster, children are trafficked. They disappear. And I think this latest incident is proof positive on how important it is that we put children first and we determine whether they are without parental care and that we can get them to a safe place to determine their long-term outcomes.
Well, tell me about the condition of these kids. Are they basically healthy? Are any of them injured? Are any of them in need of special care?
Well, of those 33, we know that at least a third needed medical attention. We also have SOS staff from around the Caribbean who have come in who are psychiatric social workers. We know that many have been traumatized. Some were dehydrated, and our job was to stabilize them. They're healthier now. Some are with their brothers and sisters, as you know. And so, first and foremost, they are safe and they're well taken care of. And now we'll figure out the next steps and where their interests best lie.
Well, these 33 are just, you know, a portion of hundreds of kids that now need care in Haiti. How many kids do you normally care for in Haiti, and how many do you have now?
Well, we have two SOS villages in Haiti, one in Cap Haitien in the north, and then our one that's really almost at the epicenter of this earthquake and this situation, which is SOS Santo, about 12 kilometers outside Port-au-Prince. We normally take care of 200 orphan and abandoned children there and raise them and educate them. And now we have expectations that we're going to be taking care of 500. And so we're in the course of determining more long-term shelter, train caregivers, and ways in which we can sustain them and educate them. So this is a long-term process. We're in this for the long haul, for years, years to come.
Well, the New York Times is reporting today that they've actually stopped evacuating children from Haiti because of this case with the Baptist group. People are afraid that they're going to be accused of kidnapping, which is having a chilling effect on airlifting kids out of Haiti. And I'm wondering, you call this a cautionary tale. What should we be learning from this case of the accused child trafficking and possibly kidnapping of Haitian children?
Well, that we do need proper documentation. Paperwork sometimes is perceived as something unnecessary and creating stalemates and delays. And we hope that that's not the situation. They certainly need to be identified before they leave the country. But I know that SOS is working in collaboration with all the NGOs, Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, World Vision, together with the Haitian government. So I hope in these collaborative sessions we can determine which children certainly are severely at risk and injured and need to get out of the country for much better medical assistance. So let's hope this stalemate is very short-lived.
Well, as you say, these 33 kids that you're taking care of are just part of the 500, I guess, you're going to have.
Right.
What if the kids say to you, you know, I was in a terrible situation at home? What if the parents say, I couldn't take care of my child?
I think it's a set of varying conditions. We know that some parents absolutely were devastated enough to want a better life for their children. We have to help them keep their children and sustain them by helping that family first.
Okay, Heather Paul is the CEO of SOS Children's Visit Villages in the U.S. It's an international organization that helps orphaned and abandoned children in about 130 countries, including Haiti. Coming up, we're going to tell you a little bit more about the marvelous, magical city of Vancouver. They're hosting the Winter Olympics. We'll go there in just a minute. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And it's believed there are about 200 detainees currently at Guantanamo, the detention center that Barack Obama claims he will close, but hasn't yet. Many have been released, and some go back to their home countries and are never heard from again. Some, we've reported on this program, have actually been implicated in terrorist incidents in places like Yemen. Some end up in court. But it's the rare ex-Guantanamo Bay detainee who ends up on stage.
Prisoner 661. 4 a.m., hand over your blanket.
They try to keep their hand clean, but they send me to Egypt for torture. I've been beaten, electric shock, every second.
That's the voice of Mamdou Habib, who's a former Guantanamo Bay detainee, performing part of his monologue in Waiting for Mamdou. It's a show that opens in Sydney, Australia, in a few hours, actually tonight, Sydney time. Phil Mercer, BBC Sydney correspondent, joins us from Sydney, Australia. Phil, you've seen this show as a way of conveying to the world what went on in Guantanamo. How well does this detainee, Mamdou, do?
Well, he does pretty well, given that he's not a trained actor, and he's trying really to express what he says are the awful conditions he endured after being arrested in Pakistan a month after the 9/11 attacks. He said he was sent to Egypt, where he endured, in his words, some horrific torture. He saw people murdered in front of his own eyes before being taken to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba in May of 2002. And Mamdou Habib's aim in all of this is really to show the Australian people exactly what happened to him and, in his opinion, what part the Australian government has played in what he's described as a global conspiracy to erode human rights.
And, of course, the themes that come up in this show are, of course, the treatment, the torture at the hands of international authorities. He was a victim of rendition. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's right. This play was co-written by Mamdou Habib, but also explores his wife Maha's troubled experiences in Australia. They claim they were raided several times by Australian security agencies. And since Mamdou Habib's released from Guantanamo Bay in the early part of 2005, he was repatriated to Australia. He is an Australian citizen. He was born in Egypt, moved here in 1980. And since his release, he claims that he's under constant surveillance by the Australian authorities. We've yet to hear from the Australian government about those allegations, but safe to say that these claims by Mamdou Habib have been enthralling audiences during opening night here in Sydney.
And certainly Mamdou Habib has had plenty to say about his adopted country, Australia. Listen.
The public in Australia, they very naive people. People doesn't believe what's going on. We talk about democracy. We were talking about the freedom. We talked about human rights. We don't have that. People have to know the truth.
Does this show by this former Guantanamo Bay detainee deliver truth, or is it more entertainment?
Well, it's not something you would necessarily take your children to see.
Right.
It is quite a gripping account. And what the producers say, they want to transport people in a very small way to Guantanamo Bay. And in terms of entertainment, well, it's probably more education, but certainly pretty hard-hitting.
Well, enthralling and hard-hitting, according to Phil Mercer, BBC Sydney correspondent, talking about the premiere of Waiting for Mamdou. It's a show, a monologue by an ex-Guantanamo Bay detainee that opens tonight in Sydney, Australia. Thanks, Phil. Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. And hey there, you know, the Winter Olympics are going up there to Canada, you know.
Hey, oh, yeah, I'm going to have some syrup and some donuts.
Coming up, a discussion of how Canada is so far beyond the cliches about it and the community of Vancouver, a portrait of one of the most beautiful places in the world in just a moment. We're also talking about the First Lady's fight against childhood obesity. If you're a big loser, what's your story?
My name's Caitlin, and I'm calling from Brooklyn. I was an obese child, and it just really wreaked havoc on my life. Since becoming an adult, I've been dropped about 100 pounds, and my quality of life is just so much better.
The importance of dealing personally with childhood obesity. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post your story to the website at thetakeaway.org. Check on leading stories now at 48 minutes after the hour. Iran says it's begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%. Far short of the 90% needed to actually make a nuclear weapon, but it still increases fears that Iran is edging closer to the infrastructure to actually create a bomb. Earlier on The Takeaway, professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, Hamid Debashi, said the new move by Iran is a sign of internal dissent.
What Ahmadinejad is doing is trying to bring the global attention away from domestic woes of his, towards either the geopolitics of the region or the nuclear issue.
Yesterday, the U.S. and France called for strong new sanctions on Iran. Toyota says it will recall more than 130,000 Prius cars and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids in the U.S., part of a worldwide recall of vehicles to fix brake problems.
First Lady Michelle Obama is launching Let's Move, a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. She tells ABC News this morning, the occasional unhealthy treat is okay in moderation, but
the question is, how do we help people balance that out so that they're not facing life-threatening, preventable illnesses?
First Lady says she wants her daughters and the rest of America's children to learn more about better nutrition and exercise. 19-term Congressman John P. Murtha has died, powerful appropriator and Vietnam veteran, and the longest Pennsylvania congressman ever to serve. Murtha was a powerful presence on Capitol Hill. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is with us now. Todd, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
We've heard a lot about his national influence, especially on the Appropriations Committee, but let's talk about him locally. What was John P. Murtha's influence in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, 19 terms in the 12th Congressional District. This is Johnstown, PA. That was his hometown, about 40, 50 miles east of Pittsburgh. The 12th District, Celeste, used to be a center of steel and coal industries, and those industries left and devastated the local economy in the early part of Murtha's term. So instead of just sort of letting the economy stay in shambles, he used his influence as a powerful defense appropriator to transform Johnstown from a devastated ghost town to an unlikely hub of defense contractors and military suppliers. Today, there are at least 24 defense contractors in this tiny town. There's an annual trade show bankrolled by some of the largest contractors in the business. It's called the Showcase for Commerce, and it's all because of the defense earmarks and defense contractors that Murtha steered to his town.
Is he a beloved figure there, or just more like an institution?
Beloved figure. Take a quick drive around town, Celeste, in Johnstown, and you'll see a couple of things that are interesting. The John P. Murtha Neuroscience and Pain Institute. There's the John P. Murtha Cancer Center and the Murtha Pavilion. There's another cancer center named for Joyce Murtha, his wife, and, of course, the John P. Murtha Regional Airport in Johnstown.
Okay. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick talking about John Murtha, the congressman, passed away yesterday. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
We got one fine looking multicultural face. It represents the future of the human race. He comes in red, white, yellow, black, and many shades of brown. Thank you very much for coming around.
And with the official Olympic song for the 2010 Winter Games, That Canada Song by Mark Grant,
We begin our discussion of the Winter Olympics, which begin this month in Vancouver and in the stunning mountains of western British Columbia. For many in the world, this geologically spectacular fusion of ocean and forests and mountain snows will be the star of the show until the medal contests get down to real business. Vancouver is also a fascinating cultural center on the Pacific Rim, a mix of Western Canadian toughness and Asian sophistication. And with a portrait of this community about to absorb an onslaught of media, fans, and athletes, we're joined by Rebecca Bowett, who's the author of the Vancouver-based blog Miss 604. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
And Ian Austin is the Canada correspondent for our partner at the New York Times. He also joins us from Vancouver. Ian, thanks for being with us.
Oh, no problem. Good morning.
So, Rebecca, what's the one thing you want people to know? I mean, I've been to Vancouver. It is one of the absolutely most beautiful, fascinating, fabulous places in the world. It's one of my favorite places of all time. But what do you think people should know about your community?
I think that it's just such a mix of kind of outdoors and city. And for a while, we've kind of been Toronto's little sister city in Canada, and we just want to build up that we are a world-class city. We have great resources here, and yeah, it is just a beautiful place, like you said. Thanks.
Ian Austin, it is visually spectacular, but what is the sort of cultural and economic significance of Vancouver as a Pacific Rim city?
Well, you know, as you mentioned before, it's obviously the Pacific Rim gateway. What the city, I think, is hoping from these games is to reposition itself. It wasn't that long ago that near the hotel where I'm now sitting was nothing but acres and acres and acres of sawmills. It's moved past that. It's a big film production center, video game center, sort of a knowledge city, and that's what it wants to redefine itself as.
And what do the bloggers say on Miss 604, Rebecca Bowett?
Well, people are really excited. Yeah, it is also emerging kind of as a tech hub. There's a huge blogging community, social media community. So a big thing about especially these games in the city in particular is there's a lot of citizen journalists out there. So everyone has their camera and their recorders for podcasts, and everyone's just writing up the storm about what's going on.
And is the onslaught of the Olympics something to be feared if you're a blogger, or something to embrace? And any bad guys and good guys shaken out in the discussion so far, Rebecca?
No good guys and bad guys yet. I think everyone's pretty open to just going out there, having a good time, creating content, and trying not to have a camera where they're not supposed to.
Right, because the security will be a huge issue. Ian Austin, the weather has not really cooperated. At least I'm looking at the temperatures. I do know the melting point of water, and it's it hasn't broken freezing there in Vancouver much this winter. Is anyone worried?
Well, I mean, of course, the organizers are never worried when it comes to bad weather. It's a lovely spring time period right here in Vancouver itself. It's not an issue for the downhill skiing. That's about 2 hours away in Whistler, which has a record amount of snow. What it is an issue for are aerials and snowboarding. The resort where they're being held at the lower levels is very, very soggy, becoming very, very muddy. So they've been pushing and airlifting snow down from the top of the two mountains of that resort to the bottom where things like the half pipe are.
Rebecca Bowett, is Whistler kind of like an Aspen of Canada, you know, a place where the rich go to play in the winter, or is it more of a working class ski resort?
It's a bit of both. It's got a great international community. We've got lots of people who come up from Australia and go there, and we have people who just take day trips up from Vancouver. But then you also have your condos and your resorts. But it is very accessible for anyone of any income.
What event does Whistler really favor? Is it the downhill? Is it the slalom? Is it the jumps?
The downhill is really huge. The bobsleigh run is also there, the sliding center. So I think a lot of the more of the outdoor and also the more wintry-looking activities will happen there, since it's not quite happening on the North Shore.
All right, so Ian Austin, if you want to get away from anything cosmopolitan and avoid the sense of international community and get your straight dose of Canadian, straight ahead, you know, sort of my era Canadian, where do you go to hang out?
Where do you go to hang out in Vancouver? You should be asking the local blogger about that. I mean, you know, the city's showing its street cred by showing off its worst neighborhood, the downtown east side. You get a bit of Canadianism everywhere in the city. Certainly there's as many Tim Hortons outlets as Starbucks.
And Tim Hortons, of course, a coffee place that's very famous, just started here in the United States. Rebecca Bowett, where do I go to have a moose head, hey?
To have a what? Sorry.
Yeah, see, what a jerk I am. I'm turning off our Canadian listeners in droves. Where do you hang out in the city? What's your favorite place?
In the city, oh, there's so many different places. You can be right downtown in the downtown core, or you can head out to Commercial Drive. You can head out to South Main. Those would be some great areas, especially during the games.
And
best
sushi.
They're not kind of in red zones.
Right, best sushi in the world in Vancouver, at least outside of actual Asia. Rebecca Bowitt, author of the Vancouver-based blog Miss 604, and Ian Austin is the Canada correspondent for the New York Times, who joins us from Vancouver, where the Olympics are coming, and they're getting ready.
All day today, we were talking about the First Lady. She has a new drive. Speaking of the Olympics, they're pretty fit people, right? Pretty in shape. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, wants everyone to be in shape in the United States. And so we're getting your tips to help out Michelle Obama. Give her your tips on how you lose weight, how you eat well at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Chris wrote on our site, I'd have to say drinking too much beer has caused me to gain weight. My solution, I've switched to gin.
Great. You're having a good week there, Chris. Nominate your good week, bad week at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.